You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Can any one object define New York City? What about 101 objects? New York Times urban affairs correspondent Sam Roberts wrote an article for the paper about 50 objects that he felt embody the city story. And then, based on readers' comments and suggestions, he expanded the list into a book with choices ranging from prehistoric times to items associated with 9/11 and Hurricane Sandy. A History of New York in 101 Objects, which is published by Simon & Schuster, is now available in paperback with color illustrations. And I'm pleased that it brings Sam Roberts back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Was this project inspired by the British Museum's A History of the World in 100 Objects?
Indeed it was. It was inspired by their book and their radio series, which I thought was fascinating. And, of course, the conceit of this book is that you couldn't possibly tell the history of New York in a mere 100 objects. It would take at least 101. And the hard part in researching my book, frankly, was winnowing it down to 101. There were just so many that I could possibly include. And when I wrote the original story for The Times, I asked readers to make suggestions as to what else they would include and was bombarded with suggestions. And what fascinated me was they came not just from New Yorkers in the city and in the metropolitan area, but from people all over the country and all over the world who had some sort of connection to New York.
Many of the objects in the book are important not just to the history of New York, but to the history of the United States. Now, are you continuing to collect suggestions from the public for additional objects?
I absolutely am, because I'm hoping there will be a sequel to this book. I think there's a lot more to say. And one of the things I found so fascinating about it is the ability to tell history through objects. It's just such a more interesting way. You can tell history through chronologies, through people, through events. But this is just a more fascinating way of doing it. And I think it appeals to people and their imagination in different ways.
And we're inviting listeners to call in with their suggestions or to write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. On Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. But you also have a place that they can write into. Is it, maybe I'm getting it wrong, but objectsofnyc@gmail.com?
That is correct. People can send their suggestions there. It's in the book. And anything they want to add that I may have left out. And the thing I wanted to stress is that this is not the list of 101 objects. It's my list, a very subjective list. And the idea was to start a conversation, start a discussion. And as I say in the book, let the parlor game begin.
And we've already been receiving some suggestions from listeners. When we get to the particular objects, I will bring them up. People who are making their own suggestion, thinking perhaps you are a little off. In the case of a bagel, for example, I will mention George from Brooklyn writes on our show page, I think the Bialy should have replaced the bagel in the book. It's local to the city and isn't found anywhere else in the country, whereas you find bagels everywhere, even if they are really awful.
Well, that's a good point.
But then again, there aren't so many good bagels in New York anymore.
Well, that's true. I thought the bagel was a New York institution. It sort of started here, even though, of course, you can trace it to Eastern Europe in its real origins. People suggested so many items of food. It was fascinating. Given all the suggestions of food and given the decline in crime in the city, I thought maybe the city's slogan should be, leave the gun, take the cannoli, because people were suggesting pizza and empanadas and bialys and bagels and every other form of food imaginable. Pizza I ruled out because I thought it was more ubiquitous, and bagels have become ubiquitous, but as you say, often in a frozen and non-authentic form, and I think New York has authentic bagels, and I would agree, also authentic bialys.
How much did you learn about the city while you were researching this book, things that you didn't know before?
Well, a great deal. And the whole point of the objects was not just to look at a tangible three-dimensional thing, but to use them as a starting point to learn. So one of my favorite objects is a ticket to the Third Avenue trolley which ran in Manhattan, obviously, in the 19th century. And that is symbolic, emblematic of a woman named Elizabeth Jennings, who got on the trolley in Lower Manhattan in 1854, and she was kicked off. She was on her way to a Sunday sermon in a church to play the organ, and she was a black woman, and blacks were not allowed on the Third Avenue trolley. They had their own trolley, a separate black trolley. And she sued. She hired a young attorney named Chester Arthur, who went on to become the president of the United States.
When Garfield was assassinated.
Indeed. In fact, he was sworn in New York in the only existing building where a presidential president was sworn in. It's now a spice store on Lexington Avenue. But Chester Arthur represented her, defended her, and she won. And in 1854, in Brooklyn Supreme Court, a justice ruled that you could not keep a black person off a public conveyance if they were well-dressed, well-behaved, and this was 100 years before Rosa Parks. And I learned this about New York City history in a way I never would have learned without looking into this object.
You have a whole bunch of things about New York City transit. Object number 46 is about... the sterling silver subway throttle that was designed by Tiffany's.
Yes, indeed. 1904, Mayor McClellan used that throttle. He was supposed to just pose with it when the subway opened, the IRT at City Hall. He got a little carried away, though, and used the throttle to drive the subway all the way uptown to the alarm of a number of transit officials who were watching it. Fortunately, he relinquished the throttle when he got up to about 155th Street and let the actual motorman drive back.
Not surprisingly, you report that the first train was 10 minutes late.
Yes, indeed. Things haven't changed that much.
But hadn't blasé New Yorkers assumed the subway would never actually open?
They had, and it delayed opening because of problems with financing. London built its subway before ours, and it was involved with lots of problems with money, with politics, a lot of the same problems we're facing today. So when you look at the fact that the Second Avenue subway is going to open maybe in December, maybe early in 2017, a subway that was first proposed in 1929, you can understand the skepticism people had back in 1904.
Was the subway an immediate success in 1904?
It was an immediate success.
That was the IRT.
It was the IRT. It started at City Hall, went up the east side, and where the shuttle is now, switched over to the west side. And when you look at the subway lines, you could see the actual arteries of growth in New York City. The growth patterns in the city followed that subway.
Object 75 was a subway token. Would a MetroCard represent New York just as well?
Well, Leonard, God help me. In the original story in the Times, I used a MetroCard because I thought the subway token was just too obvious. And did I catch hell from readers of the Times?
And then Bernie Sanders revealed that he thought we were still using tokens.
Indeed, he did. A Brooklyn boy who has not been back to Brooklyn in too long, I guess. But everyone said, how could you possibly leave out the subway token? So in the book, I not only included the token, I included pictures of it on both sides. And everyone, I hope, was happy about that.
And this book has lots of pictures. It's called A History of New York, 101 Objects by Sam Roberts, who's the author of Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America. And I was thinking about Grand Central because of the oysters and the oyster bar. And most people still call it Grand Central Station, even though it's Grand Central Terminal.
It is indeed. It is a terminal because trains terminate there. In fact, if they didn't, we'd have a lot of accidents because that's where the tracks end, unlike Pennsylvania Station, where the trains can go through to Long Island or through to upstate New York or through to New England. It's interesting because when I wrote that book about Grand Central, the subtitle of it was How a Train Station Transformed America. And I was concerned that that was a little bit too audacious. And then I thought, well, if I say a building can transform a country, what about an individual object? And in researching this book on objects, I realized that, in fact, objects can be transformative. If you think of the wheel, if you think of the crucifix, if you think of the computer chip, if you think of which face is on a $10 bill, these are things that, in fact, can be transformative in our history.
And you write in your introduction that you wanted to avoid larger objects such as the Statue of Liberty and the Empire State Building.
You know, one of my criteria was that they shouldn't be bigger than a bread box. And I admit I cheated on a couple of these.
You have the Fordham Gneiss and you...
The Fordham Gneiss, G-N-E-I-S-S, the rock formation sticking out of Spuytenduyvil, one of the oldest things in New York City, and also the spire of the Chrysler Building. But for the most part, I wanted things that were kind of quirky, things you wouldn't normally associate, and things that we could learn from, which is why you'll find something like an artichoke and an automated cotton picker, not the kind of things you would automatically say are objects you would associate with the history of New York.
You'd have the Fordham Gneiss, but is that the same thing as the Manhattan Schist?
It's not. Fordham Gneiss actually is a little bit older than Manhattan Schist, but Manhattan Schist is...
We're talking millions of years.
Millions of years, indeed. Fordham Gneiss is in the Bronx. There's a little bit of it in Manhattan, too. But the Manhattan Schist is in Midtown Manhattan and Downtown Manhattan, and that's why, for the most part, you will see skyscrapers in Lower and Midtown Manhattan. Now, of course, we have the capacity, the engineering skills to build them anywhere, but initially, engineers wanted to build them on that solid rock formation, and the best place to build them were Downtown and Midtown.
And it's really north of Wall Street, which would mean to me that the old World Trade Towers were north of the Schist.
Well, yeah, and remember the old the World Trade Center was built on a lot of landfill as well, and that necessitated those real strong foundations, that tub, if you will, in which the World Trade Center was built.
We have invited calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. And you can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. George from Brooklyn, what are you suggesting?
Hi. I'm suggesting Joey Ramone's leather jacket.
Good one.
Yeah.
I tell everyone who makes a suggestion that would have been my 102nd object, but I would definitely include that on my next list.
All right.
Thank you for calling. Christine on Facebook wants to nominate checker cabs, but checker cabs are in the book.
The checker cabs are indeed in the book. One of those icons of New York. In fact, I think you could not have a book about New York without the checker cab, that yellow, you know, bulky taxi that the taxi cab of the future that has replaced it, the Nissan cab, I think it's just nothing like the old checker.
Well, she also nominates those two extra seats that you just flipped down and were so practical.
They were indeed. And I'm not sure why, maybe for safety reasons and lack of seat belts, we don't have them on those new cabs.
There also are those extra seats on the subway.
That's right, the flip down of supposedly.
But you
the
only
handicap,
see them some places.
That's right.
You'd think that that idea, well, my big problem with the subway is the old seats were so much more comfortable, except that people put knives into them and destroyed them. But the current ones are way too small for most of
New Yorkers'
butts.
Well, they're too small for us, at least, yes. I'm not sure that they may not be way too small for anorexic young people, but they are for me, I have to admit.
Jono from the West Village, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you? Gentlemen, I love this book. I love this segment. I'm wondering if there's any object in the book, such as a ballot referendum from, I believe the year was 1898, 1895, where Brooklyn stopped being its own city and became a borough. Surely any object that changed the actual layout and demographic of the city merits inclusion into a book of this nature.
Leonard has the book in front of him. There is something marking the consolidation of the city in 1898. One of the things that's in there is civic fame. the statue on top of the municipal building, which sort of symbolizes the consolidation of the city. And to me, what's so amazing about that, another thing I learned, is that the model for civic fame was Audrey Munson, whose face you will see on many monuments around the city. It turns out she was a porn star who ultimately was committed to an asylum upstate, involved in a murder case, and committed suicide. So I can't imagine a better model, I guess, for Miss Manhattan, at least according to Brooklynites at that time, than Audrey Munson.
And it should be pointed out that WNYC had its studios underneath that statue for most of its history. We've only left around 10 years ago, maybe less than 10 years ago, came to our current location.
The statue has since been gilded, though.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Sam Roberts, whose latest book is A History of New York in 101 Objects, published by Simon Schuster, now available in paperback. He's also the host of the New York Times Close-Up on cable channel NY1, author of 8 books. And we are inviting you to give us a call at 212-433-9692 when we come back from a little break. You can also write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Sam Roberts, who is the host of the New York Times Close-Up on cable channel NY1, and also a, what's your official title at the Times?
Urban Affairs correspondent, and at the moment also writing obituaries, which are fascinating biographies of people.
And maybe the New York Times obit page could have made it into this, because a lot of people, after a certain age, a lot of people turn to the obituary page first, then they look at the front page to find out whether we're at war or not.
Indeed, and a new book out, A Book of the Dead of Times Obituaries.
Some of these things really do come as a surprise. For example, you include a 17th century English Low Dutch dictionary. What's Low Dutch?
Low Dutch is a sort of corruption of the language, more of a street vernacular of the language. And the reason that that's in the book is when the English invaded, so to speak, they really didn't invade. They came and the Dutch welcomed them with open arms because they were so fed up with the administration of Peter Stuyvesant. That the English took over without much of a fight and kept most of the Dutch institutions. They figured let well enough be alone. And they let the Dutch have their weapons, their taverns, everything else, and their legal system. But the only problem was the language. So the dictionary became sort of the Rosetta Stone, if you will, of translating between the era of Dutch rule, which was about 40 years, and then the next 100 years or so of English rule.
And I mentioned that words like cookie remained in the New York lexicon. Do you have any idea why some Dutch words were preferred over the British words?
Not really. They
just, chocolate chip biscuit just doesn't sound right to me.
It does not, and nor does a black and white cookie, which was my favorite. There were a lot of foods, as I say, recommended by readers to include in the book, and I exercised author's prerogative by including the black and white cookie, which was my favorite.
So, let's take some more calls. Our number here, again, 212-433-9692, the on-air number. John from North Plainfield, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. You might want to include a photograph of the uniform that was worn by the 14th Brooklyn of the New York State Militia. 14th Brooklyn was unique in that it was the only unit that fought during the Civil War that was called into service for the federal government by name by the president. Moses O'Dell, who was a congressman in Brooklyn at the time, which happened to be the third largest city in the country, was a confidant of Lincoln, and the governor of New York wouldn't allow the 14th to march down to protect the country, and Lincoln called them into service to fight by the 14th. And they remained 14th Brooklyn throughout the war. They were named the Red-Legged Devils of Brooklyn by Stonewall Jackson for their tenacity in battle at the First Bull Run or Manassas.
Now, Brooklyn, of course, was an independent city at that time. The rest of the city didn't react as well. There was a draft wheel, a draft that was implemented by President Lincoln. The Confederate Army already had a draft, but the North did not until
No,
then.
The North did not, and in 1863, one was imposed. And one of the objects in the book is that draft wheel. And interestingly enough, to make sure that the draft was fair, that wheel was spun by a certified blind man to make sure that the names that were picked out of it were indeed random. Now, the fact is, of course, they weren't random, because if you were rich enough, therefore not likely to be an Irish immigrant, you could buy your way out of the draft. And that is one of the objects in the book, that draft wheel, which is now at the New York Historical Society.
You could pay $300 to the Union Army. $300 must have been a lot of money.
That
in those
was
days.
Indeed a lot of money. And Boss Tweed, endearing himself to Democratic voters, floated a bond issue to end the draft riots, in which the city would pay people, in effect, to get out of the draft.
Didn't the regiment have to be called back after winning the Battle of Gettysburg in order to restore peace during the draft riots?
Indeed, the army had to come back from Gettysburg to restore peace in New York City. It was the largest civil disturbance in what was the United States at that time.
Bob from Paramus, you have a suggestion?
The Norway rat.
The Norway rat as opposed to rats from other parts of Europe?
Well, I think that's the technical name for the rats that first came over from Europe on various ships and found themselves at home in New York and actually all along the U.S. coastline.
Well, that's why I didn't include the rat, because I didn't think it was unique to New York. But actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, because one object I would have included that would have been my real 102nd was the inflatable rat that you find at some construction sites. To me, that would be the symbol of the literally and figuratively the air going out of organized labor in New York City, the rat that is put at non-union sites by the construction unions.
Thank you for your call. One of the interesting things is a guidebook that you include there. Now, there have been thousands of guidebooks of New York, but you include one by Daniel Denton. Was that the first?
Leonard, that is certainly one of the first. And the reason I put it in the book was because it is a guidebook that extols the virtue of investing in American real estate. It is written by an Englishman for an English audience. And what he doesn't tell the audience is that he owns a lot of land here.
And so this was self-serving.
It was self-serving, and in a great American tradition of, you know, hucksterism, selling real estate. And if anything is emblematic of New York, of course, it is that.
Another thing that has become emblematic of New York is the African burial ground. Now, that was covered over at one point and only rediscovered within the last 20, 30 years?
That's right. Only in the early 1990s and memorialized in part thanks to David Dinkins when a new federal office building was being built at the site in Lower Manhattan. It's now a part of the National Park Service, the federal park system. That was a small part of a much larger burial ground reserved for African Americans. And that, remember, was beyond the original official city limits. Blacks were not allowed to be buried within the city limits.
So we had a lot of segregation in New York. You talked about the trolley segregation earlier. Blacks could not be, in fact, we're talking about not just slaves, but also free blacks were buried in this burial ground because it shouldn't be mixed with white people?
Well, we forget that Federal Hall, the site of Federal Hall, is where George Washington was inaugurated as president. And just down the street, there was a slave market. And New York had the third largest population of slaves of any city in what became the United States.
Let's look at some of the things that people have been writing in. Gene writes to a show page about another common object smaller than a bread box, the City by Key, which is a recent addition. Mike, official Manhattan Borough historian, wants to know why radio technology isn't represented in your book. You have an answer?
Well, I should have included a WNYC microphone. Absolutely, Mike.
Or a mic clip, anyway.
Right.
Steve.
There's only one item in the book that I couldn't find, and that is Bobby Thompson's 1951 home run ball.
But you found the bat.
The bat is there. The bat is in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. The ball is a mystery. It's sort of the holy grail of baseball, and it is believed to have been caught by an errant nun from Buffalo who was not supposed to be at the polo grounds that day, and no one knows where the ball has disappeared to.
It is, as far as I was concerned, it was a knife that was in my heart as an ardent Dodgers fan.
You and everyone else from Brooklyn.
Stevie on Facebook nominates the octagonal paving stones that you see on our New York park pathways.
Nice.
And Michael nominates both old pickle barrels, like the ones used by the pickle guys on the Lower East Side, and Tom Otherness statues in the 14th Street L subway station.
I love those. The alligator coming out of the sewer.
Somebody DC on Twitter nominates Run DMC's mics or turntables because rap music really does come from New York. And Christian called in to argue with you about Audrey Munson. He said she wasn't a porno star, but really a live nude model, which is a totally respectable profession.
Well, it's respectable now, but let's say it was not respectable in the early 1900s. He is right. She was a nude model and appeared nude at a time when it wasn't considered all that respectable. Now we would consider it art, I think.
I think all of that changed somewhere around the end of the 19th century when art schools started, but often only wound up getting prostitutes to model because respectable women wouldn't do it. Mike from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Yes, I wonder if the pink Spalding handball is included in Mr. Roberts.
It is.
Collection.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Because that
the Rosetta Stone of fun for kids.
Very important for Puerto Rican stickball culture, as espoused by Vito Marcantonio. Thank you.
And it is, of course, a Spalding, not a Spalding.
But it was more than just a Puerto Rican thing.
Yes.
It was all kids in New York played with the Spalding at one time. It's a high bounce ball. And as I said, it's been called the Rosetta Stone of urban childhood fun.
And
Are they still around?
They are definitely still around, being sold because people still love them. And I say in the book that they were originally produced as a mistake, apparently, because they were tennis balls without fuzz. And someone suddenly realized they were great for playing stickball.
You've included oysters, because they were really ubiquitous when Europeans first came to this area. And they became a major staple of the early restaurants in New York. Are there any oysters in our area anymore?
There are no edible oysters in our area. We are seeding New York Harbor with oysters now, mostly to purify the harbor because they are terrific filtration devices. The betting is that if they work, we'll be able to eat oysters from the harbor probably in a couple of decades from now.
Something else that disappeared is the automat, which you include here, although it started in Philadelphia?
It started in Philadelphia, but it really prospered in New York. I remember the last one was on 42nd Street just next door to the Daily News building where I used to go when I worked there. And was a great New York institution.
And Edward Hopper's famous 1927 painting of a woman eating alone is called Automat. They were giant successes, so why did they eventually close?
They were giant successes and great social institutions, too. They were great social levelers, as I point out in the book, because you weren't allowed to tip. Everyone had to use the same change. There were no waiters. And one of the things that happened was when they changed the price of coffee, and therefore you could no longer use nickels and dimes, and then they began to compete with fast food places, they just lost their cachet, unfortunately, and went out of business.
Why did you include a picture of Groucho Marx introducing Johnny Carson as the new host of The Tonight Show in 1962?
Well, I thought Johnny Carson and his view of New York was such emblematic of the way people viewed New York around the country, the way that New York as an institution was seen by people around the country. John Lindsay was mayor. This was fun city in a ironic sense to so many people. This was the city where, you know, you didn't trust air that you couldn't see or breathe air that you couldn't see.
The city of muggings, lack of garbage collection.
Exactly. And this was the view that so many people around the country had of New York. It was a city that people loved to hate.
So maybe we should have felt relieved when Johnny Carson moved to Los Angeles.
That's right. And then when ultimately things turned around and The Tonight Show came back to New York. And that's one of the things I tried to show in the book, the resilience of the city. And that's why, you know, one of the problems I had was dealing with the 21st century. You know, what objects are going to be relevant decades from now? What are we going to look back on? And two of the things I picked was for 9/11, a jar of dust that was collected at the site in Lower Manhattan. I don't know what's in that jar, and frankly, I don't want to know. But the enigma of it, I think, was so fascinating. And becomes symbolic of what happened that day. And Superstorm Sandy, the hurricane, a concrete Madonna that survived the hurricane and the fire in Breezy Point as emblematic of New York City's resilience.
And you also included an AIDS button.
Very important. The AIDS epidemic, you can argue that a lot of it had an impact in San Francisco, but I think in terms of people, in terms of patients, in terms of the arts, in terms of fashion, in terms of the theater, it had a major impact in New York and had a major impact in changing people's attitudes toward the gay community.
You have the I Love New York logo that was designed by Milton Glaser in 1977 for an ad campaign to increase tourism. How about Saul Steinberg's famous New Yorker cover that depicted a New Yorker's view of the world, at least the country?
Leonard, that's there too. But one of the things I found fascinating in researching the book is that there were at least two earlier versions of that Saul Steinberg caricature, that cartoon, which showed New Yorkers' myopic view of the world looking from Manhattan and seeing as far as 12th Avenue or the New Jersey Shore. This from the 1920s and the early 1950s at the very least. Saul Steinberg did his best at refining it, but this is a view that was attributable to New Yorkers way before Saul Steinberg.
We could have an updated version even today.
We could indeed.
What's the story behind the blue and white cardboard coffee cup, the thing that we get for coffee takeout?
Well, as I point out in the book, we never could have had a Law and Order episode without that. Thank you for your patronage or whatever the blue and white coffee cup says with that Greek key design on it. It was designed by a Hungarian immigrant, a survivor of the Holocaust, who was working for a paper cup company in Connecticut. Now it may arguably have been overtaken by Starbucks, but you could still get that I'm happy to serve you or it's our pleasure to serve you in every form, including ceramic versions. And that is certainly one of those things that has become emblematic of New York.
What about its name, the Anthora?
The Anthora, like the Spalding, another New York corruption, a corruption in this case of the amphora, which is, of course, a Greek vase.
Now, we've gotten some more suggestions from listeners. Murphy from Harlem says street clocks that are embedded in the sidewalk near Wall Street.
I love those, and there are not many of them left. There are a couple in New York. There's one also, I think, up in the Bronx. And according to the Department of Transportation, people have to pay a fee for those, believe it or not, a small fee, whoever owns those clocks. There are a couple of them, and there are a couple, of course, standing clocks. One of the stories I did recently for the Times was the fact that at Trump Tower, Donald Trump never got a permit to install his clock in front of the tower, one of the things that he seemed to brazenly disregard.
Although I don't think it's going to cost him the election.
I don't think that alone will do it.
Alice suggests on Twitter the plastic key used at the Bronx Zoo to start the music boxes in front of exhibits.
Nice. That's a good one. And also the skate key for roller skates was another thing a number of people suggested.
And Elaine from Long Island writes on her show page, a box set of the entire Seinfeld series.
That's great. I think that could be included as a good gift for NYC listeners.
Earlier this month, the Landmarks Preservation Commission opened the first municipal archive. Are there 1 million artifacts now stored on West 47th Street?
There are indeed 1 million artifacts. These are things that were dug up by archivists, by archaeologists, by urban anthropologists for the city, and they are stored now at that site, and many of them are cataloged online.
Is it open to the public?
It is open, I believe, by appointment to researchers, and many of them, as I say, are digitized and available online.
So we've gotten a number of really good suggestions here, and you have a place for people to make more suggestions?
Yes, they can go to objectsofnyc at gmail.com. And I would say that if people are torn between buying my book and donating to WNYC, I would urge them to donate to WNYC this week.
Well, they can get the book and donate. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. If you do an updated version, are you just going to do a second, or will you do a history of New York in 250 objects?
I think I've got enough for 250, Leonard.
But right now, it's a history of New York in 101 objects. It is now available in a very handsome paperback from Simon & Schuster. And Sam Roberts, it's always a pleasure having you on our show.
Leonard, thanks so much for having me.